This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. One of the key agreements to emerge from the Summit of the Americas in Monterrey, Mexico this week was to deny refuge to corrupt officials, those who corrupt them, and to their assets. To demonstrate American resolve, Secretary of State Colin Powell agreed to return $20 million to Peru, which the U.S. said was tainted. In just a moment, we'll speak with a reporter who attended the summit about the significance of this agreement and the haggling that surrounded it. Afterwards, we'll talk about how we define corruption, how it takes root in both the corporate world and in governments, and about the role of compliance in encouraging corruption. How can it be stopped? Does the U.S. define corruption differently than other countries do? And what role does corruption play in international relations? Later in the program, an update from Hartford, where the Connecticut legislature is set to start an inquiry that could lead to the impeachment of the governor, and we'll bring you the latest on the SEC's investigation into payoffs in the mutual fund industry. But first, have you ever been asked to grease the wheels of a corrupt system, either here or abroad? If you have stories about tickets to the policeman's ball or kickbacks for contracts, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from Mexico City is Richard Boudreau. He's Los Angeles Times staff writer. He attended the Summit of the Americas. It's good of you to be with us today.
Good to be with you.
Tell us about this corruption agreement. What's in it, and who signed on?
What's in it is what you said. You were reading the language from it. It's an agreement among 34 countries in the Western Hemisphere, the United States, Canada, and Latin American countries, to deny refuge to corrupt officials, those who corrupt them, and their assets. That means that when a corrupt official takes refuge in another country, the leaders of other countries are supposed to take steps to extradite them to their home countries and seize their money so that it can be returned to the treasury from which it was looted.
In the not-too-distant past, there was sort of an unspoken agreement among a lot of countries in Latin America that if a leader fled one country, he would find safe haven elsewhere.
Right. This was sort of an informal mutual protection club among Latin American leaders, whereby their peers in neighboring countries would offer them a sort of asylum whenever they were facing legal troubles back home. So this agreement is really a blow against that arrangement. Although there's still a lot that has to happen before this agreement will have any teeth.
Well, there are countries in the hemisphere who are known to be sites for assets of corrupt officials. There are places like Belize, the Cayman Islands, places like that. Are they part of this agreement now?
Yes, their leaders were present at the summit, and they signed it. What this agreement, in effect, asks them to do is to sign on to a convention against corruption that was organized by the United Nations and signed late last year. Some of these countries that on that list, like Honduras, Belize, Bahamas, Cayman Islands, Jamaica, other famous safe havens for dirty money, have not yet signed that convention. So they're now committed to doing that.
Well, given all of that, was this agreement contentious?
Surprisingly not, in the sense that nobody wanted to be voting against a treaty that required them to stand up to corruption and take action against it. What was contentious was that the United States proposed that there would be a paragraph in this agreement that any country not complying with this new agreement should be kicked out of the Organization of American States and barred from future summits. And virtually every country in Latin America was opposed to this because they thought it would be hard to determine with fairness which country is corrupt. And they thought that it could lend itself to political manipulation, whereby maybe, say, the United States, if it wanted to kick Hugo Chavez of Venezuela out of the OAS, not have him come to a meeting, they could say that he was harboring corrupt money and officials from other countries.
Now, this is on the scale of this agreement addresses the scale of, you know, sort of leaders of countries absconding with funds. What about corporate corruption? Did that come up?
Well, yes, it did, because as you call the language would be to deny refuge to corrupt officials and those who corrupt them. So this is they're taking aim at big companies, even multinational corporations. This is an issue. This is interesting because this has often been taboo in past discussions among Latin American leaders. They didn't mind going after corrupt officials, especially if they belonged to a previous government. But they didn't want to be messing with big companies. So this is a call to crack down on both sides of the corruption equation, not only the hand that receives, but the hand that gives.
About the gesture of the Secretary of State Powell returning $20 million to Peru, where did this money come from, and how was that gesture received?
It was received with open arms by President Toledo of Peru. This money was looted from the Peruvian Treasury by Vladimiro Montesinos, who was a former intelligence chief of Peru under former President Fujimori. Toledo welcomed the money back, but pointed out that Montesinos has more than $200 million more stashed in foreign banks, and he's still trying to get that back.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Richard Boudreau took the time out after landing at Mexico City's airport to wait around to speak with us. You heard the soundscape of the airport behind his voice there. He's the Los Angeles Times staff writer who joined us from Mexico City, just returning from Monterrey, Mexico. Well, joining us now is Prakash Sethi. He's the president of the nonprofit organization International Center for Corporate Accountability. He's also a university distinguished professor with Baruch College's Zicklin School of Business, and it's good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
And as we just heard, this agreement signed in Monterrey, Mexico, addresses not only corrupt officials, but those who corrupt them. So as we talk about corruption around the globe, how common is the perception that U.S. corporations are corrupt?
Well, it's not only the U.S. corporations. When it comes to large projects all over the world, especially in developing countries, I would say most large corporations, regardless of the country of origin, are equally suspect, because they all try to gain advantage from the country in terms of either contracts or other benefits, which, if they were brought to light in public, would not be acceptable. And so I don't think it's just a question of U.S. corporations. The biggest problem is large corporations in countries where the social and political infrastructures are not very good, democracy is not very well functioning, and therefore the leaders have tremendous power to cut deals. And the large companies are not too averse to cutting deals if it makes sense to them, and especially if they have an opportunity to keep them secret.
Can you give us an example, one that sticks out of you know, how this might work?
Think of, it would work if there was a common understanding and public pressure, something like what we call publish what you pay. If Exxon and Mobil and Chevron, whenever they paid licensing fee or contract awards in these countries, and they made public exactly what they paid, there would be some accountability. Most countries tend to make this as state secret. And so it generally becomes the deal between the company and the country's leader, whether he's a military general or a non-elected but pseudo-elected president. It's very hard to know. These laws make very good sense, but I am not optimistic that they would make that much difference in the long run, unless until the information can be made public, or there is reasonable assurance that such an information would become public, which I'm not sure is possible right now.
For there to be corruption, there has to be a corruptor and a corruptee. And do you have any indication as to whether, you know, it's how often it is the government in power that says, you know, maybe if you made a little donation to the Interior Minister, this might go a little more smoothly, or whether it's the company that says, hey, if you give us this contract, you know, perhaps you'd like a vacation in on the south of France for the rest of your life?
There is much more to it than that. It's not that simple. Think of this way. If you had 20 companies all trying to get a contract or a concession to drill for oil in country X in Asia Minor or in outside the west coast of Africa, there's only one concession. These companies would do anything that is possible to get it. And so long as the other person does not know, and they could make a deal with the country's leaders, they would all try to do that. Until very recently, France and Germany actually allowed these companies to take a tax deduction on the corruption or the political, not political, on the payoffs that they made. It's only recently changed, but it would be a long time before the practice gets essentially acculturated that everybody knows it cannot be done. Now it's a question of, yes, you have to be a little bit more cautious. It simply means that the cost of poker has gone up, but the poker itself is not outlawed yet.
Most of us, of course, do not deal with the corruption on the scale that you're talking about with international corporations and with high officials of government. But that's not to say that Americans do not have experience of corruption on lesser levels, and we're asking people to call in with their experiences on that. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. And let's begin with Sandra, who's calling us from Sacramento, California.
Hello. I am of Mexican descent. My parents immigrated from Mexico in 1951, but I was born and raised in the United States. Every year we would take a family trip, car trip, from L.A. to a town near Guadalajara. Along the way, we would get stopped, of course, by customs officials. And in order to avoid unpacking our very packed full trunk of the car, my father would routinely bribe them, and we would get waved through. And it's not that we were carrying anything that was illegal. It was just the hassle of unpacking the trunk and packing up the trunk. So growing up, it became just routine for my brothers and I to see my father do this, and we didn't think anything less of him. We understood that the customs officials in Mexico were paid very poorly, and that essentially the bribery is considered part of their salary. And it wasn't necessarily said as a bribery. I mean, my father would just kind of hand them some bills and say, oh, here, go and have yourself a beer. And that was understood that they would just wave us through, whereas we would watch other families who either didn't have the money or didn't know how to do it, the system, end up having to unpack their whole car and pack it up again in the heat of the Sonoran Desert. Later in life, when I was applying to medical school, and my father said, well, who do I bribe, essentially, to make it easier for you to get into medical school? And I said, that's not how it works in the United States. I mean, I may have been naive, but I said, I mean, unless you have millions of dollars, you know, bribery in the United States doesn't, that's not how it works.
Yeah, maybe a research wing might have
yeah,
helped.
I told him, I said, if you have enough money to you know, build a wing of a hospital, then maybe that would get me in easier. The interesting thing is then that about 3 years ago, I was traveling with my own family, my daughter and my husband.
Very quickly, Sandra.
Traveling there, and I ended up getting stopped by a traffic cop, and I ended up putting to use the skills that my father had shown me by bribing a cop so that I wouldn't have to pay a bigger fine.
Thank you so much. More on corruption after a break. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about corruption, how it works its way into corporations and governments, and how it affects the way countries do business and the way we run our lives. Of course, you're invited to join us. If you've ever been influenced or affected by corruption, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Prakash Sethi, a university's distinguished professor with Baruch College's Zicklin School of Business. And before we go on, I just wanted to ask you about Sandra's call just before the break. And is that what we're talking about, to some degree, a culture of corruption?
Well, this is true. In most poorer countries, this would be everyday practice. It is illegal, yes, but it is really not bribe in the conventional sense of the word, because everybody knows what is being done, and clearly it is inefficient. It would be better if we paid these police officers and especially bureaucrats a little bit of a higher salary, that they would do things differently. But let's not get very righteous about the U.S. We do these things all the time here, only we make different kind of euphemisms about it. What would you call a $500 plate chicken lunch when you are paying this money, or $1,000 when you have President Bush or a major senator giving a talk? You're not there just to please him. You're there because you're looking for a gain in the future. All you need to do is see when a legislation is passed and how many goodies are there for special interest groups and the lobbyists who got millions and millions of dollars in order to do that. Is this not a bribe? It certainly is in my book.
Certainly.
Or what would you call political action committees? They're another form of paying for political favors where we do not have, for example, in India and other countries, well, the businessmen pay it differently. But at the end, whether the knife falls on the melon or the melon falls on the knife, as my mother used to say, it's always the melon that gets it.
Is transparency not an issue, though, if you buy that $1,000 a plate dinner to attend a speech by President Bush that's noted down as a contribution? If you donate to a PAC, that's on a list somewhere. People can look it up. People know who's donating to the candidates.
Yeah. That's true. It is transparent. But its effect is not any different. If I did not have $1,000, so what if I knew that the other person was able to pay $1,000 and get an entree? Does that make it right? I don't believe so. It makes it obvious. And why is it any different than a bribe to a local bureaucrat of $5 in India every time you do it? It's the same thing. It is transparent. Everybody knows it's a bribe or it's a facilitating payment. Well, to me, those $1,000 dinners are no more different than facilitating payments of $10 to a bureaucrat in India.
The object
is the same.
Let's bring Jeffrey Sonnenfeld into our discussion. He's Associate Dean of Yale University School of Management, and he's with us from the studios on Yale's campus. Nice of you to be with us today.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
How do you define corruption for the executives who take your class?
Well, you know, it's a great question, because I think that the way you've been approaching the discussion so far has broken out a number of rich dimensions, of course, from the national and international perspective, as well as looking at the corporate governance dimensions of a culture within a company, and then dropping down to the everyday personal existence that where we go through, and we have either personal concessions we make or coercion on top of us. Through those different levels, there are some universals that cut through, and then there are some where, as Prakash was talking about it, and hi, Prakash, he's my hero when it comes to social responsibility. I have to tell you, Neil, we are lucky to have the world's expert. Not overtly, but I'll accept a donation, Prakash. But it was there really is second to none. If we weren't on the air, I would tell you the way he has courageously put his personal career in jeopardy throughout his academic life, to say the truth, and he's always come out the winner. But the definitions, some are universal, which I think Prakash would agree. As Neil, you were rightly coming to a critical distinction, I think, on the bribery dimension, this one of transparency. Is it something which is covert, those payments that are below the table versus a political contribution above the table? Now, if there's some expressed or somehow implied commitment of government action that's going to follow, or a political action that's been purchased through donation. That's different than just overpaying for rubber chicken at some restaurant for a fundraiser. Similarly, transparency, I think, is a critical dimension that's universal. Another has to do with a misdirection, where the funds are explicitly to be used for one reason and directed elsewhere. Outright theft that follows from that, like we've seen, whether or not governing families in Indonesia to Cowdersport, Pennsylvania. We have seen that, say, Adelphia is something where you draw parallels to the Riotti family in Indonesia, where people seem to have a hard time drawing boundaries between what was public ownership and what was somebody's private wealth, the issue of then outright theft. I think, you know, the allegations against Kozlowski or of Tyco are similar to that dimension. There are issues that come off as abusive that if we not to drag Prakash back in, or I think he would agree, do vary by country. He's been working to establish some universal codes of conduct among employers in terms of what's considered fair practice. But there's a lot of debate between what's considered responsible corporate behavior in terms of salary and employment benefits and things, when people in different parts of the world are willing and eager to accept conditions that we would consider to be substandard to the point of abusive here in the U.S. But these are some of the kinds of dimensions that come out, Neil. I think the Monterey backdrop, though, is fascinating when you position it against some of these major collapses of trust, like, say, a company that couldn't be more global icon than perhaps Boeing, where Phil Condit himself, the chairman, now seems to be the former chairman, having been embroiled in the scandal around the Boeing experience. And as one of our nation's largest defense contractors, one of our most global businesses, he also was chairman of the Business Roundtable, supposedly promoting good governance and trust. And these kinds of things actually do, I think, come back and hurt us. At our last CEO summit, and by the way, feel free to stop me whenever you would.
We want to get some more listeners in, too. Yeah.
We run a school for CEOs. We asked them, has the U.S. Lost any credibility globally over trade protection issues, for example? And 37% of them in June told us, the CEO said, no big deal. Now 87% are quite alarmed. Similarly, growing resentment over U.S. products abroad. Now they tell us it's 70% of major CEOs are worried about that, whereas only 31% in June. Mm-hmm. There's a major study that's just come out today that Edelman Public Relations Worldwide has brought out that takes a look at trust in U.S. global companies. Across the board, within the U.S., it's increased, but confidence in U.S. firms is discounted by up to half going internationally.
We do want to get back to the phones, because we've got a lot of callers stacked up, and they seem to have some interesting stories to tell. Let's go to Stanley, who's with us from Downingtown, Pennsylvania.
Hi, how are you, Neil? Thank you.
Sure.
My story is that in the mid-1960s, when I was in my mid-20s, I was a low-level political appointee in the New York City government for the Department of Marine and Aviation. We had an issue where pushcart peddlers were selling hot dogs in front of this individual's diner, and he had tried to arrange a meeting with our deputy commissioner and a police inspector to get them away from his restaurant. In May of that year, he called me and asked me if the commissioner had met with the inspector, and I went up the hall and asked the commissioner and came down, called the man back and said, yes, the meeting has been held. In December, I got an envelope with no return address marked personal, which meant the mailroom wouldn't open it. Inside was a letterhead from this man's restaurant and $50 in cash. I called him up. I said, why did you send me this? He said, just to say thank you for your returning my call. I said, well, you did say thank you when you said thank you. He said, if you don't want what was in there, you have to bring it back. And not wanting to do that, I donated it to a home for disturbed adolescents so they could buy an amplifier.
New York City government, of course, no stranger to corruption on a slightly even larger scale than what you encountered.
Well, and that was my lesson, that if I would be bribed $50, which would probably be $100 now in our money, just for a phone call, imagine when there were real services rendered.
Well, thanks, Stanley, very much. You're no longer in New York City.
No, I'm happily not. Thank you, Neil.
Thanks very much for the call.
Okay.
And Prakash Sethi, cultures of corruption certainly alive in this country on low levels as well.
Well, this is true all over. I really feel that at this level, my biggest worry is where not so much the man on the street has to pay a little bit to get the job done. It is abominable. It is unappetizing. But it's done. Sort of greasing the wheels. But my still biggest problem is at the upper level where you really undermine the whole country's stability by doing those things. And Jeff is absolutely right. If we could really enforce the concept of transparency, for example, if we could argue that all oil companies that sign concessions would make their financial arrangements public, we would have much less problems at the level where it really makes difference. It is not so. The other area where you have not mentioned, but which I have come across, is the sheer callousness of some of the government officials in the countries I deal with, where they would take bribes even when it might cost thousands of lives of their own people. Let me give you just one example. I would not name a country. The country was suffering with tremendous amount of malaria, and the current medicine was not working very well. The malaria had become resistant to it. One company that had a very large operation there, in order to protect their workers, offered to bring a more effective or robust version of the medicine from Australia. And the health minister's office called and said, if you were to deposit $300 million, you would get that permit. The country had a policy of not importing any products unless until it could be shown that they cannot be manufactured in the U.S. Hmm. That product was not imported for at least 3 years.
At the cost of unknown numbers of lives.
You are absolutely right. Those are the guys that should be hanged. I wish I could do that.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Herb, who's with us from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Hey, how you doing, Neil?
Okay, Herb.
I'd like to say thanks for, I listen to your show impeccably from the day that 9/11 happened. You've kept me upgraded on all the events, so I've been into it. But I had a, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, all right, sorry about that. I had a, where we were on a towing service out of Michigan, and we would get on the call list, and they would call you as accidents or tows happened, whatever, you know, abandoned vehicles, you would be on their call list.
Mm-hmm.
But we would routinely, police car broke down, we'd go tow it, there would be no charge, flat tires, jump starts, pull them out of ditches, you know, accidents, there was never any charge to a city. And, you know, it was kind of an unspoken thing. As long as you were, you know, scratching their back, they were, you know, they were scratching your back. And so, you know, you'd get on the line there, and they'd call you, well, we've got a tow for you. You've got a broke-down motorist. Well, 2 days earlier, you just changed the tire on your police car.
So this was...
You were always, you know, doing something for them, and they were, well, here's some business for you.
Go along and get along.
Yeah, and it works up. Now, I drive a big truck now, and it even works in the trucking industry. You get a ticket out here for 4, 5, 5, 10 over the limit. You don't want any points on your license. Well, if you'll pay me... for a non-moving violation, which is usually twice what your moving violation would cost, this will never go on your driver's license.
Well, Herb, thanks very much for the call, and thanks for the kind words, too.
Thanks, sir.
Okay, bye-bye. Have a good day. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in. This is Peter, and Peter's with us from Mountain View, California.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I have just to report that bribing sometimes is so... financially beneficial that even if you yourself do not benefit from it, you just hate to pay the customs inspectors or the organizations that demand high fees from you, and you surround go around them by paying a bribe, a small bribe. I remember in Jakarta I had to bring in some equipment for a ground station, and customs demanded $21,000 in customs duty. Otherwise, I wouldn't get it. I could see it sitting out on the runway. So I went to a little organization called P.T. Swift, which really asked me, gave him the papers. I said, here, go ahead, get it out and get it to my station, which was about 200 miles away. And they said, oh, that's going to be expensive. I said, well, how expensive is it going to be? Well, you might have to pay $200. I said, wow, that's a lot, you know. But I give you 100 now and 100 when you bring them. And they did. 3 days later, it was on site. Now, can you imagine that you trade $21,000 in honesty for $200 of this little cheat? You know, and this goes on in a lot of countries.
I'd be interested to get a reaction from both our guests. We just have a couple of minutes left, but Jeffrey Sonnenfeld, okay. If you would compare what Peter was just talking about and what Herb was, two different levels.
Yeah, well, Peter's experience does raise up an issue when you think of doing business at times in Indonesia or quite often in Nigeria or China, where somehow a commission essentially was paid. And Prakash might say, how is this really different than the commissions that are paid in the States for things such as the brokerages we have or agents? You know, what is an agent really doing? Well, sometimes the agents are doing it. It gets back to the transparency issue where it's above board and we know. But a lot of times to do business in different lands, we're essentially outsourcing the dirty work to somebody else through an agent to do what we ourselves wouldn't do. Question of transparency is a major question. A second question has to do with the magnitude of it, because sometimes you just have somebody gives a $5 bill to a maitre d' for a better table. The magnitude is not great, but the principle is still wrong. Mm-hmm. But then there's a third one, which is, of course, is the consequences. When you have perhaps a Brooklyn family court that's corrupted by judges being paid off, so it's leading to very different family outcomes. I mean, it's just absolutely devastating to trust in the system, not just the quality of lives for individuals, is that these things have to be weeded out on all these different levels, or the market timing that we saw in the mutual funds.
And more about that later. Yeah. And Prakash Sethi, we just have about a minute left, but I'd be interested in your response too.
No, Jeff is absolutely right. And the gentleman who talked about Indonesia, he is absolutely correct. And the problem is even far more serious, because in many cases, I know personally, the medicines have been stuck in the customs houses for 6-8 months till they became obsolete because the company or the individual refused to pay the magnitude of the bribe that he or she was asked for. And that's where a collective action and transparency could really bring about social change that would save lots of lives. No bribe is ever justified. No bribe is ever acceptable. But it's just like the degrees of crime. Given limited resources, one would need to go to the worst problems first and hope that the others would be solved as things move up.
Peter, thanks very much for the call. And we'd like to thank both of our guests for being with us today. Prakash Sethi, we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Prakash Sethi, a distinguished professor at Baruch College. His most recent book is Setting Global Standards, Guidelines for Creating Codes of Conduct in Multinational Corporations. He was with us from our bureau in New York. And Jeffrey Sonnenberg, appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Jeffrey Sonnenberg joined us from the studios of Yale University, where he's Associate Dean Associate Dean of the School of Management. When we come back, an investigation into the corruption of the governor of Connecticut. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.